Welcome to The C Word, the Conservatives podcast. Today we're talking about early career freelancing.
My name is Liz Abair. I'm a private paintings conservator based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
My name is Sophie McAloon and I'm the conservation manager and an easel painting conservator at Fine Art Restoration Company in Carlisle in the UK.
My name is Isabella Rossi and I'm a textile conservator at Rossi Conservation in Dunbar, Scotland.
So Jenny, our sponsors, BevArt, have come up with they've brought out a new product. So
they have?
Yeah. So do you remember the nano sensor?
Oh, the teeny tiny one. I love it.
Yeah, it was like so cute. But they've actually brought out a new one that's called the Pro Sensor.
Ooh, what does that do?
Well, that one is about the size of a Lego brick. Oh,
that's still very small.
Continuing the Scandi theme. On point. And it actually has triple the range of the nano sensor. So it's like ever so slightly bigger, but like still really small.
That's still tiny. Because I remember trying to hide these massive bricks in cases like... Yeah. You know, that used to be how it was, like just trying to hide something that was the size of a, I don't know, minimum a computer mouse, if anyone remembers those.
Yeah.
The notion that it can be the size of a Lego brick now, that's really elegant.
It can measure relative humidity with amazing accuracy. It's like plus or minus 2%.
Mm.
And it has a 15-year battery life.
Wow.
So you basically don't have to charge it. So basically, it can do continuous precise monitoring even during a power outage or in a really remote location. You don't need like a local Wi-Fi. So here it says gateways with mobile connection automatically send data to the cloud. No need for local Wi-Fi.
Oh, so you can use a mobile network. That's clever.
Can you actually explain to me like what the benefit of that is?
So, well, I'm just thinking that mobile coverage is pretty much everywhere. I mean, maybe not if you're somewhere super remote and like really, really, really rural, but it's pretty common for, you know, you to have mobile signal pretty much everywhere, except maybe up, you know, up a mountaintop or something, right? Because now we have really good coverage because we need our mobile phones to work everywhere. So if you can use that rather than you having to install Wi-Fi, because in some places you just can't get Wi-Fi, like, you know, you'd have to run, I don't know, fiber optics into a building and it's impossibly expensive and you just can't do it. If you can just rely on the mobile signal, that's a huge saving potentially.
Yeah.
You know, that's really cool.
On their website, they've got this nice video where they go to this really snowy castle in Norway where they've installed their system, monitoring system, and it's got like thick stone walls and it's just like in the middle of, you know, it's like on a mountain. And they've got it working there.
Nice. So. Yeah, see, that's the kind of location where it would be really difficult to do that, right? So that's really cool. Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. That's really handy. Yeah.
And it's a subscription model, so you don't need to be the person that troubleshoots, you know? So if anything goes wrong...
You've got a customer care team. You got that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, that is nice. So. It's nice when you don't have to be your own IT support team.
Yeah, and of course, obviously, you can back up all your pre-existing data onto that system really easily.
Very good. Oh, nice one. I think Liz probably has the really small ones, doesn't she? Presumably. Ooh, actually, I'm not sure what size of logger she has. I can't wait to see her video on it.
I'm a bit jealous, actually.
Yeah, I don't think they want to send all of us loggers, but Liz got to try some out, and I'm super envious.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep an eye on our YouTube channel. It'll be up there soon.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both for being on the podcast today. I'm already curious because, Izzy, I didn't hear a Scottish accent when you spoke. So maybe let's begin with some background on both of you and how you got into conservation. I'll have Izzy start.
So as you picked up from my accent, I'm not Scottish, I'm American. So I'm from Connecticut, which is a state in the northeast up by New York. So I guess the way I got into conservation is my mother is a curator for a small local history museum. And so I was kind of aware of the museum heritage field from an early age. Just kind of in high school, I was really interested in making textiles, sewing, embroidering. You can probably see my mannequin behind me right now. And then I was also getting really into chemistry. My mother suggested textile conservation as a way to combine my interests in textile making and in sciences. And of course, being a teenager, I ignored her because she has to be wrong. And by the time I got to university, I thought, like, oh, maybe she was actually right. Kind of focused my education from there on out.
Great jumping off point. There have been a few episodes already this season where we've talked with people about how you can get into conservation like through a craft skill initially. Mm-hmm. And that textiles is always my first example for that, just because it's so easily accessible for everyone to understand. Yeah.
And I think to be a textile conservator, I'm sure this is true of other types of conservation, but you really need to have that manual dexterity. You need to know how to sew if you want to be a textile conservator. So I think it was very helpful starting out in the field already having those hand skills.
Okay, great. And then Sophie, how did you learn about conservation or get into it?
So I had a teacher when I was at school who told me about conservation because I was always, like Izzy, kind of very good with my hands. I was a very good painter and I could copy things really well. I wasn't the most imaginative out there, so I was never going to be an artist. But one of my teachers said, you should look at this. And at the time I was like, oh, okay, you know, that's interesting. But, you know, you're kind of 15 years old. You don't know what you want to do with your life. So I put it to the back of my mind. And then I did a history of art degree for my undergraduate degree. And as part of that, I lived in Venice for 3 months, which was amazing. But when I was there, I saw loads of conservators working on site in all the churches and was like, actually, this is such a great combination of all my interests because I was really into history and art, obviously. And I knew I had these kind of practical skills as well that I wasn't really using. So then I looked into it more and decided that I would give it a go and train in painting conservation. And here I am. So
fantastic. And you still work as a paintings conservator?
Yeah, my time is split kind of 50-50. So it's quite nice. I get to choose the projects that I'm working on a bit more in the studio because we're quite a big studio. And then I manage a team of 8 conservators.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is all disciplines. So I would have a few paintings conservators and then objects, frames, furniture. So I've also got to learn a lot recently about different disciplines. And it's interesting seeing, I think, we don't have a textile conservator in-house, but like seeing the kind of links between all of the different disciplines and how they're similar and how they're different and how people approach it is good fun.
Well, our listeners already know about me, but for your benefit, I learned about conservation very young at the age of like 17. And so I immediately knew what I was doing for my bachelor's and my master's degrees. And then I also studied in Italy, which I think is a wonderful place to, at some point as a conservator, spend time. I was in Florence for 3 years for my undergrad, and then I went to the master's program here in Amsterdam for paintings conservation. And today's episode is specifically about being an emerging conservation professional, which all of us are. I'm curious, how many years out of uni are both of you?
I graduated in 2020, so the end of my studies were disrupted by the pandemic. So,
I also graduated in 2020. So I feel like, I guess at this point it's been 5 years, but I don't know if those first two really counted.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've talked with a lot of conservators who are, you know, in the like 5 to 10 range outside of their studies. So that falls with both of you as well. And most people say that especially working private rather than going for a museum job, you can expect to sort of settle into things around the 5 year mark. So you're settling in and you're both settled in quite nicely. Izzy, I didn't catch, what are you up to? Like, where are you working? How does your business function?
So I have my own studio. I live in East Lothian in Scotland, so kind of east of Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And then I do work for like small museums or churches or just private individuals in the area.
Okay, and what brought you to Scotland?
I originally moved to Scotland in 2018 to go to the University of Glasgow because they have an MPhil program in textile conservation.
Yeah. And yeah, a lot of people end up just staying wherever their university was. That's what I did as well. And I guess I'm curious for both of you, What made you decide to go into the private sector rather than pursue a museum job?
I think for me, a lot of it was timing. I think graduating during the pandemic, as we all know, there weren't maybe the opportunities that there are at the moment. So it was sort of a happenstance of fate, I think, because I wouldn't necessarily have considered private practice to start off with, but it's absolutely the right place for me. And it's interesting, I think, kind of what you expect when you're studying in terms of museum jobs or like how you think your career will be, and then finding what fits for you. And for me, being in a busy studio, being in a commercial practice was absolutely it, because I just love the variety. And, you know, more and more, I really appreciate that every week I get to see something totally different, whether it's, you know, a new inquiry that's coming in that we're having to like do initial proposals for, or it's like helping one of my colleagues with finishing, you know, a piece of furniture conservation. It's, you know, it's super interesting. And I find that the variety is what keeps me and my brain kind of engaged. That's, I think, why I stayed in private practice. And I'm very pleased that I did. And I think people don't really see that side of it all the time. I think, you know, museums and institutions are great and they get a lot of attention, especially when people are studying. But I think private practice has a lot to offer as well.
Yeah. What was some, because you said that you didn't initially consider private practice until circumstance. What is something that surprised you about private practice that maybe was a misconception that you had before you joined?
That's a very good question. I think it is the ability to be able to work on really kind of large scale and interesting projects. So I think I had the misconception, especially when I was studying, that in order to do really interesting, especially for paintings, like structural work and paintings on panel, especially in the UK, because we don't get that many, I thought, you know, it's going to have to be institution, it's going to have to be within that sort of sphere, otherwise there's not going to be the access. But actually, I mean, some of the projects that I've worked on are very technically interesting, very art historically interesting, really engaging. And I think I didn't expect that to start off with. And I think especially in private practice, because you do have that freedom, I think, to learn from other conservators, to kind of develop your practical techniques, to really kind of have, I guess, the pressure of having like an end client that's very direct in a way that you don't necessarily have in an institution. Kind of forces you to, I think, sharpen your skills and, you know, find what you like and find what you don't like and find what you're good at and work with other people to fill the gaps. And, you know, I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, this is something that I've heard before and that I personally really enjoy about private practice, is that you have to be a bit of a jack of all trades and really develop in multiple areas, not just your conservation skills.
Yeah, absolutely.
Izzy, working alone, how does that work for you in terms of the connection and having to create variety in your work?
I think one of the things that surprised me the most about private practice is kind of how welcoming other private practitioners are. So like if I have a question, I don't have anyone else in the studio, it's just me to ask. But every time I've emailed another private practitioner, they're always really, I don't know, friendly and welcoming and, you know, give me, you know, answers. And I mean, I guess, you know, we're all technically in business and sort of, I don't know, in competition with each other, but it never really feels like that. I don't know.
I don't think that it feels like competition. I mean, I graduated with a set of about six in my cohort, and some of us stayed in the Netherlands, some of us spread out. But even amongst the four of us that are still in the Amsterdam area, there's plenty of work to go around. It's just about everyone being creative enough to find it and finding your niche. So what is your niche, Izzy?
So I do textiles in general. Yeah. I feel like there's not that many conservators in Scotland, so I'm not really so specialized that I only do costumes or only do embroideries. I kind of do a bit of everything with textiles. I think my personal preference is for costumes, but I won't turn down an altar cloth.
And how do you define a costume? Is that historical clothing or is that
vintage? This is a question that comes up a lot.
Okay.
I find that in a lot of academic sources and as a textile conservator, we're always taught to call clothing costume.
Okay.
Part of that is to kind of elevate it as a field, I suppose. Mm. It also includes non-textile things, which would be the differentiation from clothing. So it would also include shoes or hats or bags, which may be other materials as well.
Oh, that's so interesting that you said shoes, like you started listing other objects that you put on your body, because as soon as you said things that aren't textiles, my brain went to like sequins and metal and all the different accoutrements. Yeah,
accessories.
Yeah, exactly.
And even, you know, things like a dress often has non-textile elements, like a zipper or snaps or buttons.
Mm-hmm. And I see that you have a bodice behind you. Do you use that for your own personal use or do you?
Yeah, that's right now I'm making a dress. That's not a museum grade mannequin or anything. That's just my regular mannequin. But I also have my spinning wheel here and then my loom behind that.
Oh, a loom. So do you make your own textiles as well to use in your conservation practice?
Not for conservation. Mostly because it takes a very long time. It's something I've considered, like, it would be lovely to have a project where I need a very specific fabric that I can't buy, so I have an excuse to make it myself. That hasn't come up yet, and I think it might be a bit cost prohibitive.
This is part of working with clients as well, is having to consider their needs.
Yeah.
And with clothing in particular, I'm curious if your clients want you to preserve it for display purposes. This is specific clothing, or are they interested in actually wearing?
For the most part, for clothing, I've done things for museums.
Okay.
Or like heirloom things that aren't really going to be worn, or worn very rarely. I've had some people ask me to do repairs that would make the garment wearable. But I'm always kind of wary of that because wearing things is so dangerous to the textile. Yeah. And kind of explain to them like, okay, yes, I could repair it, but it probably won't hold up to do what you want it to do. And you're going to drastically shorten the life of the garment.
Yes, this actually branches into like with client discussions. I find that one of the challenges I really enjoy is when I have a client who wants me to do something that I have an ethical issue with, because then part of the job becomes convincing them about your expertise and having to actually make the argument for your decision. And if they don't want you to do it, you have to decide for yourself what you're comfortable with. But Sophie, working with such a large group, how do you manage clients?
So we're really fortunate that we have quite a large office support team who do a lot of our client communication, which was also something that was really strange when I started working where I work now, because I expected to have more kind of direct interaction with clients. And I do sometimes. But it actually has been such a godsend because the conservation team is really empowered to kind of set those boundaries and to say, you know, this is how we do things and this is the reason why. And we're always open to having a conversation about it, but it lets us kind of set our kind of ground level of where our standards are and how we would approach something. And then we work with our colleagues in the office to help the clients understand in a way that is maybe less technical or is more in line with their expectations. So I think a lot of what I've learned, because we do a lot of work for the insurance sector as well, which is a whole different ball game to private clients in many ways, but it's all about speaking to people in their own language and like connecting with them in a way that they understand. And I think this is something that I'm guilty of, and a lot of conservators, I think, is assuming knowledge or kind of speaking in a way that, because we're trying to elevate the profession at so many different points, and rightly so, we kind of speak in a way that then it becomes a bit inaccessible to people. Mm. And so, you know, for private individuals who maybe have an heirloom that they, you know, just really care about and they want fixed, but maybe it's not very valuable, or they're not really sure how to go about it, or a friend has recommended something that's now out of date, you can't just go in and be like, oh no, we don't do that anymore. You really have to work with them and understand where their head's at. So I think
I've learned a lot from my colleagues who work more in those kind of client roles. But I think it's nice to kind of be able to set those boundaries for yourself if you're the one doing the treatment as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm sure you found the same thing with people asking for, you know, wax resin linings and old techniques.
Yeah, yeah, I've encountered quite a few wax resin linings in my time. But I'm sure that it's so helpful to have a huge support staff behind you. Izzy, how do you deal with clients being a one-woman show?
So I do everything. So I do, accounting. I was recently updating my website on my own. So I do a little bit of everything. I think especially with clients, I do find that kind of communicating to them on their level, I guess, is really important. Mm-hmm. As Sophie was saying, and I think this is partially the way we were taught in university, we kind of use all these very technical scientific words and we write, you know, 12-page treatment reports. But I feel like going into private practice, a lot of those things I've had to unlearn because no one's going to read 12 pages. It's a waste of my time and a waste of their time. And using really overly technical language can sometimes help me think through my process, but I try to give that to clients because they have no idea what I'm saying. And I want them to understand exactly what I'm proposing and not just blind them with science. I want them to understand that it's not going to be perfect and brand new at the end. And these are the reasons why. And these are what's actually possible with conservation treatments.
Mm. And then with clients as well, you've been working for a few years in Scotland. So I assume at this point you get a lot of your business through word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is, again, consistently what I hear from...
Yes, because I saw recently you had asked people where they get their clients. I've tried doing, like, cold emailing and things like that. I've never gotten any work from that. Mm-hmm. Pretty much all of my clients have been word of mouth, which isn't very helpful to say to an up-and-coming conservator. But I do find that doing networking and things like that is probably the best thing you can do for building a customer base.
Yeah. This is also consistently what we talk about on the podcast is having a diverse network, never being afraid to reach out to anybody to ask a question. Thank you so much. By the way, earlier you talked about how kind the community is and how helpful. And I think that that's very true of conservators. We're fortunate in that way. But, I'm so intrigued, Sophie, with having a whole group of conservators working together, because I'm sure that you're able to bounce so many ideas off of each other in terms of actual treatment instead of having to, you know, wait for a response via an email from somebody on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, I think so. I was really fortunate that when I started in my job, I actually started as an intern, and my now colleague was also an intern. And so we've worked together for 5 years, both paintings conservators. We both trained at Northumbria. And so just having someone there who you could bounce ideas off. And I think it's always the small ideas. It's always the, oh, can you just have a look at this retouching? Or can you just check that I'm not going crazy in proposing this? And those things where you might feel a bit kind of not silly, I suppose, but just out of your comfort zone, reaching out to someone you don't know because you think, oh, it's just like a small thing. Having someone to bounce ideas off in that way and as a kind of a little bit of a fail-safe just made all the difference, especially when we were starting out because, you know, you are quite unsure when you come out of university and especially if you're, you know, in private practice and you have to make a lot of decisions for yourself and, you know, you're really kind of leading your treatments. You know, having someone there who can offer a second opinion is just absolutely gold. And I think we've really carried that through in the studio. You know, I have a couple of interns at the moment and watching them kind of bounce ideas off each other. And then occasionally kind of like coming to ask us, like, oh, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? It's just a nice kind of continuation. And it's a really nice like environment to be in because you have that reassurance and support network. Mm. And I think what I've learned as well, I mean, this is like not just in our studio, but, you know, conferences and meeting other conservators is everybody does have something that they're just very, very good at. Every conservator, and it's always something different. And it's usually a very kind of niche, a very small thing, But, you know, everybody has like, oh, this particular material, I know absolutely loads about that, or this particular treatment, or this particular, you know, artist. And it's, I always find that really interesting, because that's when you really start to see kind of people like bounce off each other and start to be like, oh, but this and that. And I just, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, skill exchange is so important. And whenever there's an opportunity to do so, I'm thrilled. I don't know why, but what just came to mind is actually something similar happens often when people who frequently go in and out of prison, they'll get arrested for one thing, and then in prison they'll learn a new skill. So like they'll learn lockpicking in prison, and then when they leave, they've got a new skill acquisition. It's just so natural, right? We always want to share with others.
Conservation for inmates, I think.
Along those lines, what would both of you say is your skill? If you had to pick something. I can go first. Well, if you need a second to think. You mentioned wax resin lining, and I did my initial studies in Italy where they don't use wax resin lining. So I actually never learned what that was until I came to the Netherlands. And then I had to write a paper about it. And suddenly I'm writing my master's thesis about it. And I have a project that's a wax resin lining. And then my first job once I finished my studies and actually started my business was the removal of wax resin from three enormous ceiling paintings.
Wow. So I'm
very intimate with the wax resin process from beginning to end.
That's very cool. I don't know. I think I would go tear repair, thread to thread, tear repair.
Yes.
Yeah, I did one recently, which was a broken twill weave canvas. And I actually thought I was going crazy when I was looking down the microscope, because I was like, this is a twill weave, like already complicated. You know, this is a challenge. And then the threads kept switching and I was like, oh, is it a plain weave? Have I gone insane? What's happening? And honestly, it took me a good like few hours to actually get my head around what I was looking at, because I think as well, because of the way that it was, the fibers were broken, it wasn't uniform. And so I was kind of dotting in and out, and it was a great challenge. but, you know, I started to go a bit cross-eyed. I'm sure, Izzy, you relate to the weave challenges.
Yeah, I was thinking, I have my loom behind you. I can show you what a broken twill weave looks like. I think for me, it would probably be costume mounting. I really love it. So I always think of it as kind of making a, I don't know, I'm trying to think of how to explain this. My background is mostly in sewing clothing. And one of the things you do when you're making a pattern is you drape the fabric on the mannequin and then kind of put darts and shaping into it to make it into the shape of your mannequin. And I find that costume mounting is the opposite. You're shaping the body to fit the garment. I think it's quite fun as someone who has a background in sewing and then kind of supporting them. And you also get to make kind of very fun and creative poses and make strange undergarments to support the clothing. It's kind of a combination of my love of sewing, but also with the textile conservation background.
Ah, that's so cool. You know, I got to see the Met exhibit last year for the Sleeping Beauties. So this is where they displayed really rare pieces, clothing pieces laid flat, because they're so delicate that they actually can't mount them. So that's the only way that we got to see them. It was incredible to see all those materials. And I was thinking of it earlier, actually, when you were talking about being interested in making your own potentially fabrics to use as a conservator. Would you ever be able to make something for other areas of conservation, like for paintings?
I don't really know terribly much about canvases, because usually the fabrics I'm weaving are for clothing. I would assume they're very tightly woven and probably not the easiest to do on a hand loom.
You know what? No.
Yeah. I mean, they would have done it in the past. That's because that's all they had. But
yeah, maybe pre 18th century, you might be okay.
Well, I mentioned earlier, I myself am an emerging conservator. I've been out of my program for 2 years now, and the current status of my business is murky. is how I would describe it, because I'm in that situation that we all find ourselves in where we just graduated and I'm trying to balance starting a business with earning money. And I'm not financially able to rely completely on conservation at the moment. So I'm doing some alternate jobs. I give museum tours. I work at a restaurant and I nanny. So were there any jobs that you had to have early on when you graduated before conservation, or were you really able to dive in right away?
I was very lucky because I got my internship and during COVID and then just kind of stayed where I am, which is obviously not typical at all.
I think for me, no is the answer, is the quick answer. The long answer is, so I finished my program, it was August of 2020. Obviously couldn't really work because we couldn't really leave the house. and then in January of 2021, I had to leave the UK because my visa ran out. And so I went back home to the US and then waited a year and a half to get a new visa to come back. So in that time, I didn't really want to start a serious job because I was waiting for my visa and could have left at any moment. So I was just working in a bakery.
Yeah, lots of stories like this where you have to just take other jobs to supplement for a while, right? But what allows you to then make that transfer, I find, is the networking opportunities that you expose yourself to. So what are some of the early networking opportunities that you either had available or made for yourself?
I think for me, a lot of it was keeping in touch with my classmates at Glasgow Uni. So one of my first big conservation jobs after I came back to the UK was costume matting for the V&A Dundee's Tartan exhibition. And the reason I got that job was from a classmate who heard from one of the former tutors. And so once again, it was word of mouth.
Yeah, I think to second what Izzy's saying, like, it's very much still a who you know industry. And I see this even today. I mean, you know, kind of 5 years post graduation, a lot of the opportunities that I know about or have recommended to other people have come from people that I studied with. And we're all now in different parts of the industry, some in institutions, some in private practice, some in different countries. But like, that's kind of how you kind of hear about things still.
Yeah. Do you ever use conservation diss list?
Occasionally. We hosted a modular cleaning program workshop a few years ago and met a lot of people through that, and we advertised that on the diss list, and that was really good. But I think there's just, I love the diss list, but there's so much information on there that I do feel it is a bit overwhelming sometimes. I think
I get an email every day.
Yeah, and I just feel like, you know, I skim through it, and then I'm like, if I'm trying to put something on there, you know, other people will skim through it. And
yeah.
And because it's international, it's not always relevant. I find it leans more towards the U.S., which makes sense because I think it's affiliated with AIC.
It is, yeah, yeah.
But I think for conservators in the U.K., probably ICON would be the place to go to for networking opportunities.
Yes, the C word went to ICON this past summer, and that was a really great opportunity to talk, especially with a lot of the students that are either about to graduate or have just graduated, and hearing a lot of similar grievances and confusion in a way, I would say, not really sure what the next steps are.
Yeah, I think I've seen this a lot because one of my interns has just graduated, but she was with us when she was on placement. And a lot of her and I think her classmates just felt like they didn't really know what to do when they graduated or like where to look. And a few people had kind of, you know, made contacts on their placements and like had an opportunity, but you can't guarantee that. And it's just, you know, you're kind of just thrown out into the world and it's like, you know, go and find things, which I think as an industry, we do need to be better at supporting people. But yeah, it's, I feel like a problem everywhere.
How has that worked for you working with so many other people that aren't conservators by trade, but rather have found their way into a conservation field?
In terms of our kind of like office team, do you mean?
The office team and the people that you have to interact with then.
I think a lot of people have come to it because they're, I think, quite creative people, not necessarily like artistic, but have kind of an appreciation for something a bit unusual. Hmm. So I do, you know, I have colleagues who trained as art historians or kind of in more creative fields, but I have a lot of colleagues who didn't and have kind of seen this opportunity at a quite an interesting company and have just come on board with it. And it's actually really, I think it's really interesting to have such a diverse mix of people, as I was saying before, because I think as great as the conservation kind of network is, it's quite insular. And I think having a bit of perspective of people who find the field so interesting kind of reminds you how cool it is.
Yeah.
I think when you're around people who do it all the time, yes, it's cool, but you get very technical and you get very sort of bogged down in specifics. And then actually when you are talking to someone else who can't do the job but is around it, they're like, this is actually like amazing.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting.
Great for other people to also have interaction with conservators and then go out into the world and talk to their friends and say how amazing it is and how useful.
Yeah, absolutely. We have quite a lot of like Rotary clubs and like Women's Institute clubs in the local area come around for tours. We had one last week. And it's nice because, you know, people have gone for their whole life and they don't know about conservation and they're interested in, you know, museums and art and things and they have no idea. And then they can come and kind of see what we're doing behind the scenes, which is really nice.
Yeah. So many small institutions that I wouldn't have probably thought of when I was starting out with my studies. You know, I think a lot of us picture working for a big museum or something very fancy, sexy, especially with paintings, conservation, that's sort of where our head's at. But that's not what the on-the-ground experience is. And I'm actually quite grateful for that because it introduces you to a whole new swath of people and clients and opportunities as well. Izzy, you mentioned that your mom worked for a small museum in Connecticut. Can I ask which one it was? Because I know there are hundreds.
Oh, yeah, there's one for every small town.
Exactly.
She works for Shelton History Center, but she's also a freelancer who does work for other museums in the area.
Oh, cool. So we were emailing earlier. I looked back at our email chain, and there was some discussion about the vocabulary and how we each define ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we bandied about, are we private conservators? Are we freelance conservators? Now, I personally consider myself both private and freelance because I'm working for private clients and I'm freelancing. I'm controlling everything myself. But how do you both identify?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I'm definitely private practice, but I think because I mean, I'm a full-time employee for a business, so I think this is how the conversation got started, because I don't really think I've ever sort of like freelanced, because I think of that as, you know, like you said, you're kind of working for yourself, you're maybe more project-driven, you're kind of either in other people's studios or kind of running your own things for private clients. And I think, you know, I've been in the same studio as an employee for 5 years. So very different.
Yeah.
I had remembered this conversation earlier today. And so I was looking it up. It was on in the dictionary and Wikipedia and things. Like, what is a freelancer? And it seems to be someone who works for themselves and does short contract work for other institutions. And I suppose I am a freelancer then, but for some reason it didn't, I don't know, resonate with me. I don't know, occur to me that, yes, I am a freelancer. I think part of it, as I was thinking of a freelancer, someone who didn't have their own studio and went out to other studios or other institutions and did the work there. While I do most of my work here in my studio, I feel like a lot of these words are kind of loosely defined and kind of based on feelings.
Yeah, I think that that's accurate. Even when we were at ICON, we were discussing these vocabularies, and it's not just for freelance, it's also surrounding the way that we educate conservators as well. A lot of different approaches and different ways of defining that. What were the two schools that you did? You did Glasgow and you did Northumbria?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So with your university programs, how have you found that that base education has supported you going forward? You mentioned your cohort has helped get jobs, but in terms of the actual like institutions, has there been any aid or further information about careers that they were providing you with?
I think because of the time in which I graduated, it unfortunately wasn't a priority, I think, for my cohort because, you know, everything got shut down. We, you know, one day we went in and everyone was told, right, you have to take everything that you have and go because we don't know what's going to happen just before the lockdowns were announced. So I think perhaps there was less kind of onward support than typically.
I think for me, I have had quite a lot of support in like finding, I don't know, not a job because you know I work for myself, but projects, I suppose would be the word. I mean, part of it is conservation is such a small field. I know all the textile conservators who are in Scotland because there's not that many of us. And I think quite often the school will have people just Google textile conservation. The school comes up and so they contact them to fix their, I don't know, sampler or something, and then they'll send the work on to people like me.
Oh, that's very nice. So is that being done through, like, your old professors who just know that
yes. So, that, yeah, they just know me and that I'm available and I do this work, so they just kind of send things over.
Okay, good. I like asking these questions about education. I'm very interested in, like, how we train conservators, and I always appreciate when those ideas can be passed around because we all can improve and raise up the last generation or the next generation. So to end along similar lines, I'm curious, what have you noticed change as an ECP in the last 5 years? And what are you hoping continues to change in the next five?
I think I've noticed that there are more opportunities for emerging professionals since I kind of graduated. I think, and this has come from not just, you know, me being nosy and looking at all the job postings, but we've had quite a lot of freelancers, interns, like people through the studio in the last 5 years. And I think, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, you know, people were very unsure. There wasn't very much work around. There wasn't much being advertised. I think freelance projects were down in the UK as a result of the pandemic. And I think now I'm consistently hearing people have found work and people have gotten an opportunity and I'm seeing more opportunities. And I think that hopefully that can kind of continue with some upward momentum. I know ICON are doing a lot of work on the salaries benchmarking. And I think a lot of transparency in those areas would be beneficial to keep it going.
And Izzy, what have you noticed change?
So I was going to maybe say sort of the opposite.
Oh, really?
I think specifically I have seen fewer museum jobs because I think a lot of councils are cutting their budgets. They have no money. And so they are not hiring permanent staff. Just knowing like the conservators I know who live in Scotland, a lot of museums are just not hiring anyone or any new people. And then as people retire, they just don't get replaced. Mm. But as a freelancer, as a private person, the work still needs to be done because they still want, you know, cutting edge exhibitions to bring in visitors. So they're just hiring contractors to do that work instead. So I don't know if that's going to change in the next 5 years.
Well, perhaps then if you've noticed that a lot of the job opportunities are shifting towards contract-based, I do hope that in the next 5 years we see more of the training programs that exist preparing conservators for the life they will be working privately rather than for an institution.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, maybe it's a bit of a reality check for some of the training programs that actually more than 50% of their cohort is likely going to end up in private work, whether it's permanently or project based. Because I think, like you said, it's not really factored in at the moment.
Maybe we need to end on some kind of
something more positive. I do have some things to say about the Icon private practice group. I feel like we forgot to plug that at the beginning. So we're Icon PPG, Icon private practice group, and I'm the social media officer.
Yeah, and I do education outreach.
And what does the PPG do for its members?
So we are trying to kind of foster connections between private practitioners, since so many of us work in small private practices or alone like I do, and also kind of promoting this sector of the profession.
Wonderful. That's very useful.
And just some of the things I wanted to plug. So I am the social media officer, so I have to tell you to check out the Icon Private Practice group on Instagram and Facebook. And also coming up, we have our first PPG symposium on the 6th of October in 2025. We'll have our symposium, Private Practice, Where Are We Now? And that'll be taking place in York.
Okay, great. That will be in our show notes as well. We encourage our listeners to go check them out. At the very least, give them a follow on Instagram, because that's always helpful. It was lovely talking with both of you ladies today. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
It was really fun.
Thanks for listening. We're the C Word, and today you've been listening to Liz, Sophie, and Isabella. Join us next time for one of our private practice specials. In the meantime, you can check out our website at thecword.show, email us at thecwordpodcast@gmail.com, or simply find us on social media. We're on almost everything. The intro and outro music is Spring by Didi Music, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. And as always, this has been a Wooden Dice production.